It's Wednesday, April 19, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, White House visitor logs. Sean Spicer says they're not going to be made public anymore, citing security concerns. It's a blow for transparency, but does it really matter? I'll ask Mike and Ernest about that. We'll also talk about the strength of branding, both for good and for bad. We'll talk about a new commercial for McDonald's that doesn't once mention McDonald's. It doesn't show its logo or any of its food, yet it kind of works. And we'll also talk about a local Fox television station that's changing up its branding because it says the cable news network's brand, with all of its blemishes right now, is turning off audiences there. And we'll talk about the growing debate over competing street art in New York City. It's the Fearless Girl. Is she a symbol of feminism and empowerment? Or subliminal advertising threatening the freedom of expression of the iconic bull it's staring down. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but let's start with a story that's breaking now as we're sitting down to tape today's program, that Bill O'Reilly soon will be out at Fox News Channel. What do we know?
Well, I think what they're saying is that the Murdochs, or at least the younger Murdochs, have been able to sort of stage this ouster of O'Reilly, and this goes back to Ailes, it goes back to the $13-14 million that the company has pretty much paid out for his sexual transgressions, and now the enough is enough, especially with the loss of advertising on the O'Reilly factor. So, and he's been out for almost the last week and a half, was supposed to be back in on Monday, but now it looks like he's going to be out for good.
New York Magazine's been doing some really good inside reporting on this whole story. So what's kind of led to the final denouement here, apparently, is that the parent corporation's board of directors are meeting tomorrow. And high on the agenda, as you might expect, is what to be doing about O'Reilly. Apparently, there's been conversations going back and forth between him and the company on how to make the exit, how to announce the exit, what the terms of the exit are going to be. So I imagine by this time tomorrow, we'll have a pretty good sense, if it hasn't been announced earlier, what exactly the deal is. But he's probably not coming back next week. They're probably going to have a replacement in place for him starting on Monday. So now there's going to be a lot of speculation about who that's going to be.
I mean, to me, what's real interesting here is that it seems that the younger Murdochs are taking control of Fox and trying to change this good old boy image that has cost them millions of dollars and cost them advertising and has damaged their brand, and they're trying to make that shift there. The interesting thing for me is that many of their viewers like the people that that have basically been forced out. So how is that going to change when it comes to the demographic makeup of the audience of Fox News?
I think there were at least three factors. We talked a lot about the accusations against O'Reilly and the advertising boycott, but there are two other factors that I think probably weighed at least as heavily on the board of directors. One of those is the fact that there, as we mentioned last week, a federal investigation into whether the company basically deceived stockholders because of the way it handled or didn't announce the settlements. And the other one is that the parent company also is trying to buy out the majority share of a very lucrative European satellite network, Sky TV, and the European regulators expect them to sort of show that they're worthy of taking over this company, and they felt like they had to deal with O'Reilly before they got there.
Well, I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all that this is an economic issue, because above everything else, the Murdochs are all about making money. So if that means that they have to jettison O'Reilly and others who can damage the brand and hurt them financially, the bottom line, corporate-wide, then that's what they're going to do.
It would have been interesting, you know, Amy, if Megyn Kelly were still there, as to whether she would ascend his slot or not. Now they're talking about, I think, three of the five different hosts on the five, their afternoon show, Dana Perino, Greg Gutfeld, Eric Bolling, one of them might be taking over. There's talk about Tucker Carlson filling that slot. There's talk about the guy who's a producer and is this sort of man on the street correspondent for O'Reilly, who goes out and traps liberals into saying dumb things. Haynes or whatever might be the replacement. But I don't know that there's a clear winner there who the Fox News believes can carry that audience.
Or they may just change the whole format entirely. I mean, that may be something that they can try.
Just blow it up. Well, yeah. You can call it maybe a failure of media literacy and an understanding among viewers that the network and local stations aren't one and the same. That's why a Fox station in Boston has decided it's time to change its branding and drop the Fox from its name. Couple of factors here. First being that conservative Fox doesn't exactly play well in liberal Boston.
Right. And partly because the audience doesn't see the distinction between the local station and the news channel. And they also don't see the distinction between Fox-owned television stations like this one.
Well, this one's owned by Cox Media.
But a Fox affiliate station, right, and a Fox News channel, because the Fox affiliates carry all kinds of programming. And the only Fox News channel program that I'm aware of that they actually carry is the weekend talk show,
Fox News Sunday.
So there's a big difference there, but most viewers apparently didn't see it that way. They had a survey apparently that showed that like 4 out of 10 TV viewers in the Boston area thought that they had a conservative slant because of the association with the Fox News brand.
And I actually did want to talk about ownership a little bit, and the idea that this station is owned by Cox Media being based in Atlanta, the owner of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, dozens of television stations. It is a very strong, very reputable company. What does this also say perhaps about other media companies not necessarily wanting to be associated with the Fox brand right now?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where you have this sort of cross-pollination, mm-hmm, when it comes to media ownership. But it also speaks to media literacy. I mean, when you say the brand Fox or CBS or NBC and it's connected to a particular station, then the network itself and what comes with that network is connected to that, whether the actual company that owns the station is connected to that. So, I mean, I don't think the audience is savvy enough to understand the differences between who owns the station and who the affiliate is.
I think it's too early to speculate on whether or not what's going on in Boston will, you know, have any impact in other Fox stations around the country. I mean, first of all, this particular Fox station is only changing the branding for their newscasts, not for the rest of, you know, because there are a lot of popular programs on the Fox network that they would want to promote. So this news operation also is struggling in the ratings, has been for a long time. So they're trying, you know, something to try to improve that. And frankly, I think that the station in Boston, you know, even though one of their executives says, we're trying to avoid any perception of bias. Well, if there were a perceived liberal bias in a very liberal city and state, mm-hmm, probably the audience wouldn't care that much. And probably it's true in conservative, mm-hmm, states as well, where having that Fox brand and the conservative tag won't hurt you at all.
Right.
Okay, well, imagine having a brand that is so strong that you can run a 30-second commercial and never once mention the name of the company.
If you do a Google search for that place where Coke tastes so good, you'll know. And while we can't say where that is, we can say why. I'm with beverage technician Rick.
Hey, I go to make sure that all Coke is perfectly formulated for that taste.
Rick, by now you should know that we can't say... We'll have to bleep you, and it'll sound like you're swearing every time you say Now I'm saying
Oh, I'm sorry.
Rick, this is a disaster. I'm so sorry.
So we heard Google. We heard Coke. But you would have had to have been paying really, really close attention to know that that was a commercial for McDonald's, that actress Mindy Kaling was wearing a yellow dress on a red background. But you never once see the golden arches. You never hear them say McDonald's, yet you could kind of tell that was an ad for McDonald's.
Well, I think you can more than kind of tell.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't take long for me to pick up, okay, this is a McDonald's ad. I mean, this is clever. And I think it reaches an audience that is multi-generational. I mean, you know the colors. And you know that Coke is connected to McDonald's. It always has been. So that connection alone, and then all of a sudden it keeps you there because you want to say, okay, why aren't you saying McDonald's, or what's the premise behind it? And then by the end you realize, okay, this is a cross connection between Coke and McDonald's.
So it reaches us because of the color and the nostalgia and knowing McDonald's, right, and and Coke, but it also goes a long way to reach millennials and Gen Zers who, as a generation, tend to want to do brand research on their own and word of mouth amongst themselves as opposed to having a product pushed down their throats.
Yeah, I think they're the target, obviously, for the ad. And the ad alone is only a part of what's going on here because you also have the connection with Google. And they knew that if you did the search that McDonald's would pop up first in the list.
So talk a little bit about the partnership going on between Google and McDonald's here and the information that's being shared.
Well, just that, I mean, obviously, if you do a search on Google for the words that are in the ad, what comes up first is McDonald's. And so they have a direct tie-in with Google. They had the research ahead of time. But the other piece of this that I think is really interesting too, they've also got the actress Mindy Kaling you talked about, who's very popular, has on her own either Twitter or Facebook feed, says something like that, maybe you could pay me in fries, yes, right? Yes. So there's lots of little subtle hints.
And she is a loyal McDonald's fan.
Has been talking about it on late night TV for years, love of McDonald's. McDonald's biggest competitor, Burger King, had actually done some advertising in the last week or two in which it had mentioned Google too, but it kind of backfired on them. Didn't play off as well as it did for McDonald's.
The problem was they were trying to drive people to them by having them go and do the work. The one thing I like about what McDonald's is doing is that they've made it easy for you to do it and are sort of subliminally leading you to it, whereas I think Burger King was way too
direct. Mike, you smiled when I brought up the Google thing and Burger King. Explain to everybody who's listening right now what exactly happened.
So with the Burger King commercial, they actually had a line. So like if you talk to your Google Home device, or if you talk to, you know, Amazon's Echo and Alexa, you have use a key phrase that gets them started. They included that key phrase in the commercial so that when it happens, if you have a Google Home device, it's going to come up with this description of their burgers. It's very appealing, right? Except they didn't clear that with Google beforehand. And after a while, when people started, you know, playing that commercial, it didn't take them to that content on Google Home anymore because Google took it down.
So Google got nothing out of it.
Absolutely.
And didn't seem to be any kind of connection there. But the other thing was that why would people do that to begin with? I mean, to me, it was just almost like forcing it.
No, I understand trying to use a new technology and voice computing in a clever way. The problem is if you're a Google or if you're an Amazon, you don't want people pulling these kind of stunts without their approval.
They're hijacking your customer's device.
Right.
Okay, so this next one, it was put out there just in time for the International Day of the Woman. It's Fearless Girl, a 3.5-foot bronze statue staring down the iconic Charging Bull, a Lower Manhattan mainstay for nearly 30 years. When she first showed up, she was seen as a feminist icon, an inspiration to women and girls. But, well, take a listen to this from CBS News.
She spoke to the moment, that sense that women were not going to live in fear.
Artist Kristen Visbal built the statue.
Bottom line is, she says women are strong, women are here.
But the Fearless Girl's symbolic stare down with Wall Street's Charging Bull has morphed into a real-world standoff.
They are transforming illegally the message of the bull.
Arthur Piccolo is a spokesperson for Arturo de Modica, the Italian sculptor who made the bull as a symbol of hope.
Now this girl is confronting this supposedly that looks from a monstrous figure. That's an outrage to take a great work of art and transform it.
This has been one of those things where the minute that the artist called for Fearless Girl to come down, the outrage began. You know, the internet has to have something to be outraged about. It was a new feminist icon. It was empowering to young girls, and that it was degrading to women to call for this to come down. But there might be some good reason for it. First being that statue is actually an advertisement.
Yeah, I mean, it's an advertisement for a company called State Street Global Advisors. And, I mean, you could say on the surface of it, even though it was an ad, they commissioned this artist to do the sculpture, it might have had good motives. They said publicly they were trying to promote a campaign they have to get other major corporations to add more women to their boards of directors.
Well,
Sounds good on the surface.
Part of this, too, is one of the holdings that they have is an investment people can make in female-dominated companies, and that the trade symbol for it is SHE, she.
Right.
And every time in every communication about the statue, she was in all uppercase.
But even that is not just as simple, because State Street Advisors, their parent company, had just settled with the federal government and agreed to pay, what, $60 million or something like that to make some fraud allegations go away.
I mean, and they've tried to move in a direction of having more women on in their administration and on their boards. But that State Street, just like all other, like many other companies, are struggling to try to figure out how do we create, how do we bring more women in, and they haven't done a very good job of it. So I mean, that's part of their issue too, as well as, okay, you put this up and you say you're pushing for this, but you could have taken the money and the publicity that you're getting and used it in a way that really affects how women can how you can increase women in your corporation, mm-hmm. and in corporations to begin with. I mean, the problem I have, and I think this came out in one of the stories that's on the Links blog, is that it's kind of difficult to say you're for this when you have this rising inequality between what women make and where they stand in the economy and where men stand.
But here's the thing for me. Really good art has all kinds of unintended consequences.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, all the things you said about people defending the statue and how young girls have taken it as a symbol of empowerment and all of those things are true. Mm-hmm. But if you go back and look at the bull, that statue, when it first appeared there, that was a piece of guerrilla art by the sculptor. The folks in Wall Street didn't want that bull
they
there
hated
for
that
a long
thing.
Time.
Yeah.
But it became beloved. And the same thing is probably going to be true if it doesn't move with Fearless Girl. I mean, she put it there directly to be staring down the bull to send a message, and maybe that's unfair to the original artist, but he was a guerrilla artist and she's doing the same thing.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Is this going to be the time when Facebook finally acknowledges that it is a publisher, that it is a media company? It's a claim meant to wash away, the fact that it says it isn't, it's a claim meant to wash away any responsibility that might come with the way its users publish to the site, like Sunday when Steve Stevens uploaded a video showing himself killing a man and bragging that he'd killed several others. Facebook removed and condemned the video, but not before it had the chance to spread across the social platform.
You know, when this story came out, I first saw it, I felt really bad for the family, mm-hmm. and what happened, because this was just an elderly gentleman walking down the street, and you had this guy that just gets out of his car and kills him, and now it's more about Facebook than it is and the perpetrator
than it is murder.
Exactly, than it is about the victim, and that bothers me too. However, it's another example of how what Facebook and others have done in terms of bringing technology and social media and the ability for people to come together along those platforms, how that has basically been co-opted by a bad actor. And it happens over and over and over again. And that becomes the story and not what Facebook is trying to do. And Facebook is, you know, they're working hard along with others to deal with this issue. But it's kind of hard when you're talking about things that happen in real time.
There's a lot of layers to this story, too. I mean, first of all, unless you're going to say Facebook should not allow live video on their platform, and I think most people would be against banning live video, there's only so much at the moment you can do.
Right.
Partly because there's so many live streams on Facebook, you couldn't hire enough employees to monitor it and take it down in
real time.
And our
artificial intelligence technology is not up to speed to that
there.
Yet.
No.
Well, and you also run into another one of these layers that you talk about, Mike, is there is a lot of violent and gruesome stuff that is showing up on these Facebook live streams. This situation over the weekend in Cleveland, the brutal attack on a special needs teen in Chicago. At the same time, though, you also look at last summer's Facebook Live of the shooting of Philandro Castile, and it takes a little bit of a different turn, at least to me and in my mind, that even in the gruesome and the violence, maybe there's some good in getting the word out there about things happening.
And who's going to decide that? That's the problem.
Yeah.
And I don't think that algorithms can decide that on their own. I mean, frankly, if Facebook writes an algorithm, every time it identifies a close-up of a gun or whatever, it's going to say, take that down automatically. You're going to have people yelling from the other side saying, hey, that's newsworthy. You're censoring that content. If they don't take it down automatically through the algorithms, they get what they're getting now.
But here's the other thing. We're sitting here talking about how those gruesome acts are being distributed by Facebook and others. We're not talking about the acts themselves. What are we doing as a society to deal with the violence, to deal with what brings on that violence and the need to have, you know, to have that violence displayed in the way that it's being displayed. I mean, I think that's where the conversation needs to go.
I will say, too, back to your original question, I think Facebook really is facing another one of these crisis communication moments where, you know, they've tried really hard not to say we are a publisher. Mm-hmm. And that's for legal reasons as much as anything. But now they're being forced into this position because of the technologies that they make available to their users to come pretty darn close to admitting that they're a publisher. I think so far, Mark Zuckerberg and the company have tried to get out and sound responsive, say, compared to what Pepsi or United did when we were talking about their problems in the past couple of weeks. But this is a problem that's not easily solved.
And it's not going away.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there are some things you just don't do, right? Among them, outing someone. It's just, it's considered an inhumane thing to do. Well, it seems Jeff Varner didn't get the memo, and the viewers of CBS's Survivors saw that during last Thursday night's broadcast.
Deception on levels, Jeff, that these guys don't even understand. Why haven't you told anyone you're transgender? What I'm showing is a deception.
But that's personal.
It has nothing to do with the game.
That's personal. You didn't have to do that.
You know, I think I've been fortunate to play Survivor as long as I've been playing it. And not have that label. And one of the reasons why I didn't want to lead with that is I didn't want to be like the trans survivor player. I wanted to be Zeke the survivor player.
The contestants weren't the only ones who were worked up into a frenzy about what happened there. Fans of the show were pretty worked up too, so much so that Varner has reportedly lost his job because of the backlash. But as with everything, there's some context to consider. Among those, CBS's decision to air this in the first place.
Right. I mean, they taped this episode months ago. They aired it live for the first time last Wednesday. So if they had wanted to, they could have edited it or changed it in some way. They reportedly asked Zeke Smith if it was okay for them to air it, and he gave them permission, and therefore that was their excuse for not, you know, censoring it. The problem, by the way, first of all, I've watched every season of Survivor, so I know way too much about this. But there is this concern that that part of the show, which is called the, you know, tribal council, where they vote the person off the island or whatever, that is the climax of the show. It lasts about 10 minutes on the air. How are you going to edit that out and not completely wreck the narrative of that story? On the other hand, had they not worked with him and with GLAAD, you know, to make sure that they were ready for it when it aired, they might have had to think twice about it.
I mean, I think it brings up this whole conversation about, you know, he was saying that there's these secrets. Well, I mean, there's secrecy and then there's privacy. Mm-hmm. I mean, this person chose to keep their private life private, and you decided that you were going to invade their privacy and open that up to the rest of the world. Individuals don't have the right to basically take someone's private life and expose it. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you just, I mean, unless you're talking about a public figure or someone like that, you just don't have the right to do that.
Do you put a reality TV show contestant into the category of public figure at that
point?
Not in that context.
They sign all kinds of agreements to take part in a reality TV show that basically give up all the rights to their likenesses. That's the legal thing to do. The moral or ethical thing to do, it's a little bit more complicated. I mean, there's some ironies to this whole situation, not the least of which is the man who got fired from his real job,
Jeff Varner,
was one, an out gay man himself. And that seems kind of ironic after he befriended a non-out trans man on the show that he would do that kind of thing. Also, he's a former local television news anchor, so he should know a little something about privacy and where that line is. He obviously didn't follow it.
Right.
Okay, well, with the few minutes that we have left, there are a couple of other things that I want to take a look at, some odds and ends. Let's start by turning to Washington and talk about an announcement from the White House that visitor logs will no longer be made public. Reporters won't have access to the list of people who come for official meetings at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. This is a departure from what had been going on at the Obama White House, but it seems the tides were about to change there too, and Merrick Garland actually had a hand in this.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Obama administration had wanted to do exactly what Trump is doing, mm-hmm. and there was a agreement that Merrick Garland was involved in this because there was a case involving the D.C. Circuit that he was a part of, in which you had both a conservative and a liberal organization that had sued the White House wanting to open up the list of visitors, and they had made an agreement on how to do this, and it appeared to be working. But when Donald Trump came in, he said, I'm not going to release it at all. And so now, instead of it being sort of wiped with security clearances and that sort of thing to make sure that those people aren't said, now they're just saying, we're not going to let anybody do it.
So presidents before Obama basically kept these logs private. At first, President Obama did as well.
Yes, he
did. He opened up many of the records, although he had a pretty wide exception for national security reasons, right? The reasons being cited by Sean Spicer for why, you know, President Trump says, no, we're going to keep them private. But it's interesting because I think over time, journalists got used to this rare access to these logs, and they did help to tell stories about influence and about policy direction in the White House. And so now that suddenly we've lost it again, I think there's a better appreciation among journalists, if not among the public, for just how important this decision is.
Man, I agree with you. I think that it's one of those, especially when you talk about the business dealings that the Trump White House had, not to say that Obama didn't have his own set of people who were coming through who had influence, but now with this heavy dose of business leaders coming in and out, this is something that I'm sure White House reporters really wanted to have, and now it's going to curtail their ability to see what's going on.
Okay, I also wanted to bring up an interesting piece from Pointer that was published yesterday, written by Melody Kramer, comparing maternal leave policies at newsrooms across the country. She didn't name names in her comparison, but she did publish using the general size of a newsroom and the region within the country, and there were some interesting patterns in there. What types of outliers struck you?
Well, so first of all, the context that she set up, I mean, in the United States, generally among private employers, only like 12% of women have access to paid maternity leave. Fewer men have access to it, and fewer men, when they do have access to it, actually take advantage of it. In the newsrooms, it sounded like it was kind of all over the place, although most newsrooms that she talked to did not have generous paid family leave, if they had any kind of family leave at all.
You know, I looked at this and I wasn't surprised. I mean, newsrooms in general, whether you're talking about newspapers or television stations or radio, have long been places where, because of the way in which they operate and the crazy times in which people are working, it appears not to work, so they don't make it work. And that's where I think the problem is that they need to really work to make this a part of their policies and not just say, well, this is the way we do it in the news business. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that music means we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics that we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, and see what we'll be talking about next time. We're going to be taking next week off, but encourage you to keep the discussion going with us online. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music and Lauren Wartman is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again in 2 weeks when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.